help me welcome our speaker tonight, Beth, from By the Book out of Atlantic Highlands.
Hi, everyone. My name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, so I am from Atlantic Highlands. By the Book, if you're ever out near Sandy Hook, New Jersey, we meet on Monday nights. We have a 6 o'clock beginners followed by a 7:30 speaker meeting, which I am not at right now. And then we have a Wednesday 12 and 12 meeting. So my statistics. My sober date is August 1st of 2017. I have a sponsor. She knows I'm her sponsor because I'm actively calling her and doing the work with her. So a little bit about me or what I believe is part of the problem. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought alcohol is my problem. It's not my problem. It's a symptom of the problem. And what my real problem was is what I like to call conscious separation from a God of my understanding. You know, all I ever wanted in life was to fit in. I wanted to feel part of. I wanted to be loved a certain way by my parents. And it kept me separated, this ego that I have that tells me I'm not good enough. I was either separating myself by being better than you or by being less than you. And I didn't understand that at a young age when my parents were sending me to therapy because I had anger problems, that it was part of this separation that I had from a God that I didn't know that I had inside me. I lived all over the world, and I'm an only child. And I had great parents except for the things that I thought about them. My mom was depressed all the time. And the way I looked and viewed at my mom was, she didn't love me right. She didn't do enough for me. When I wanted to participate in those after-school curricular activities, and she didn't want to pick me up from them, and then I've got a father saying, you need to do these things to get into college. I felt like my parents didn't love me. But they really didn't love me the way I wanted to be loved. So I move around the world. I live in Venezuela. I live in the Netherlands. I live in some great places. But I look at it as, look at all the schools you're sending me to. Look, you're sending me to Christian school. You're now separating me from everybody again, and I'm going to school in high school now with kids that have been together since they were 4 or 5 years old, right? That's not the truth. That's a lot of them, I'm sure. But I take that one nugget that I feel that I'm missing, and I use it to separate myself. So my mother would tell me, living in school and going in Venezuela, that she wanted me out of the house, so she'd send me to school when I was 4, just barely 4. And again, I took that as she didn't want me the way she wanted me. Maybe my mom couldn't deal with me the way she needed to be dealt with, but I felt unloved. So I'm in that kindergarten, and the teacher is telling her, your daughter's so great, you know, she doesn't go to the bathroom with all the girls like everybody else does. You know, girls go in pairs to the bathroom. And I wasn't doing that because there was something in me that said I'm different from a young age. So this father that I have is drinking a lot, and today he's a self-admitted alcoholic that's still active out there. But at the age of 13, it became okay for me to drink in the house. I had a lot of experience seeing him coming home and the shape he was in and the fights that he caused and the chaos that was in the household. But when I was 13 years old, I went to a wedding for my cousin, and again, I felt like marrying into a big Italian family, and there's 300 people there, and there's 8 of us from our side of the family. And I just don't feel comfortable there. And I take my first sips of alcohol. And for me, and this isn't everybody's experience here, but for me, that phenomenon of craving kicked in right away. I proceeded to drink everybody's drink off the table when they weren't looking. I was begging my aunt and my cousin to get me more drinks. And I was nicknamed the fish. That became my nickname with my family. You know, and I would go to my grandmother's in the couple of holidays after that, and I'd be in her bedroom sneaking beers and drinking them. I was the kid looking for the hangouts in the woods with the older crowd so that I could drink. By the time I was 18 years old, I was arrested 3 times for alcohol. And I didn't think it was a problem. And maybe my parents didn't think it was a problem either. Maybe they just thought it was typical teenage drinking. But besides the fact that I wasn't coming home for 3 days at a time, I was running away. I was just that problem child, but I didn't see me as being the problem. They were the problem. To solve that problem, I'd make a geographic change and I'd go to college. No, my father always wanted me to go to college, and I had to make a career, and I had to do something, right? They talk about in Bill's story, right? He strived on, you know, went to Wall Street. You know, he did so many things, these grandiose ideas, and that's what I had, was these grandiose ideas. And if I just do this, if I just move, if I just change my geography, if I just go to college, things will be different. That will solve my drink problem. And it never solved my drink problem. I would go away for college on this great career trip for this marketing department that I was working for on the side. And I would go to New Orleans, and my father would say, please don't go out in New Orleans by yourself. This is before Katrina, and New Orleans was a dangerous town. It probably still is. I have no idea. And I thought, he's right. I shouldn't go out. You hear so many things about New Orleans, and something will happen to me. But that desire to drink was so strong, I went out, and I almost got raped that night. I was mugged at gunpoint and dragged down an alleyway, and that wasn't enough to scare me out of drinking. My next great idea was meeting a man in my hometown, because I thought it'd be a great idea to get a bartending job. And that bartending job, as soon as they said, well, you can drink behind the bar, I felt I had arrived. I met a man there who really loved me. And you know what? I don't know that I loved him, but I really liked being loved. Because remember, I don't think I've been loved the way I needed to be loved. And I would marry that guy after college, because that, again, is my way out. Maybe I won't drink the way I do if I get married. Maybe if I have a plan of what I'm going to do when I'm done with this college education, maybe things will be different this time. Problem is he drinks like me. And see, if he drinks like me, then I don't have to look at me. Then I can constantly point the finger at you and say, you're the one with the problem, because I don't want to look at me. Because I'm too delusional to see my truth. That marriage lasted for 2 years. I would make another geographic change because I was getting so drunk at work in these happy hours. And I would get in these near misses. I would get pulled over. And I would lie my way out of it. And I don't know how I really got out of them, but it was God, I guess, at that time. But I made another geographic change, and I went up to Massachusetts. If I just leave everybody, if I go with this job, take this new career endeavor, that'll fix me. And I get there, and I'm bored, and I'm lonely. Because I have that spiritual malady in me that I don't know that I have. That tells me I need to solve this. I can't stand my humanness. But drinking, I can suddenly stand my humanness. So I start going out to these bars, and I'm thinking, well, it's great. I can walk home. So as long as I'm not driving, this is amazing. You know, because I will rationalize and justify every single one of my behaviors. And I get into another relationship. And that man would say to me in the end, and I didn't hear it then, but he said, you're drinking every day. And instead of hearing him, what I heard was that you cheated on me with your best friend's wife. You're the problem. So what do? I move back to New Jersey. We'll try this again. Because I'm too delusional to see that everything that I'm doing my way of figuring things out doesn't work. But I can't see that. I'm so in the grips of my alcoholism, I'm insane. So I come back to New Jersey, and I continue my career for another 10 years. I buy a house. I have this incredible job. And I'm flying around the country. And I'm getting so drunk on the plane ride home that the stewardesses are having to get involved. I probably owe a lot of amends to passengers that I'll never see again, so I have some living amends for when I fly again. That job, because I was getting so drunk at work outings and making a fool out of myself, the humiliation, the incomprehensible humiliation that I was feeling the next day, I couldn't even describe, but I ran from that job like I ran from everything else. And I ended up looking for another job, and I landed one real quick. This will be the solution. And I ended up getting laid off by that new job that I took, probably because of my behaviors and my lack of my work ethic, because I'm drinking every day now. And I'm barely able to show up to work the way I need to, and I'm certainly not getting things done the way I need to get them done. But in my delusional mind, I'm thinking, I'll find another job. I still have a roof over my head. I'll just get unemployment. That'll give me plenty of time. I'm still okay. And I wasn't okay. And I'm thinking that my family and my friends don't see what's going on because I'm so delusional that I'm showing up every now and then. So I'm still a good friend. I'm still a good daughter. They just didn't want to say anything to me because whenever somebody said something to me, I was so defensive. And I start noticing that on Christmas and Thanksgiving and other holidays that my family gets together, I'm not being invited anymore. So what am I doing? Sitting in the biggest resentment possible. How dare they? Because I can't see that I'm the problem. They're the problem. Why wouldn't they want me there? They don't love me. Anything that I could think up in this crazy mind of mine, I was thinking it up and I was acting on it. So I'm just not going to show up and answer your phone calls anymore. I couldn't see how my behavior was affecting other people. I would end up getting arrested the year before I came in here for outside substances. And again, I'm still delusional, and I'm showing up for court, and I'm still thinking I can drink like I want to, and I'm going to lie to everybody about what happened. It's so-and-so's fault. And I started to believe that. The things that I was telling everybody else, I started to believe. That's how insane I was. So this alcoholic father that I have, that I love dearly, but I felt that he didn't love me the way I needed to be loved, I felt that if I went out partying with my dad all the time, that that's when we really connected. He opens up to me so much when he's drinking. Yay! And it was two people that were very sick hanging out together. So I would go on another one of these two-day benders with my father. He lives down in Forked River, a beautiful lake, and I love going down there. But we meet each other at the liquor store at 9 a.m. on Thursday. Starts off like every other weekend that we've ever spent together. We're going to start this day off right, nice and early. By 11 a.m., we're both totally intoxicated, and I think it's a great idea to go out and ride his motorcycle. I'm lucky I survived riding that motorcycle because a few hours later, I see that the paycheck has gone into my bank account, and I'm thinking, time to go get some other things. And for the next 24 hours until 10 a.m. on Friday morning when we were at the liquor store again, continuing our drinking together, I stopped breathing. I'd gotten so intoxicated from that 48-hour bender that I stopped breathing. And on my father's front porch, I fell over in a chair, and he had to call 911 and they had to resuscitate me. I sat in the hospital for 6 hours with my father out in the waiting room because he wasn't allowed to come see me. And I really got to think about what I had done because I thought I had been so invincible that drinking was never going to do anything to me and that the worst that could happen to me is maybe a DUI. And how many times have I driven drunk and gotten away with it? It just won't happen to me. And I can't see all the consequences of all my actions. But I start to think about them now, and a gentleman shows up in the hospital that day and 12-steps me. The book talks about having that small window. I was so broken at that time. It had nothing to do with my father. It's something that broke my heart when I saw that I was breaking other people's hearts. And some of the things that that man said to me made me realize that I have a really big problem, and it goes beyond drinking. He got me to my first meeting that night. So I leave the hospital with a father who's screaming at me, telling me I need help, and I should be put away for a little while, and I'm too insane to do that, and I'm thinking about all the things I'm going to lose, and I'll lose my job, blah, 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 and I just have that verbal vomit of, you can't do this to me, and I'll go to a meeting. My parents have been divorced for 10 years by that time. And they hadn't spoken all those 10 years because my dad left my mom for another woman, which is another one of the resentments of my 4 step. And for the first time, my dad called my mom and said, "We need to talk about our daughter." I'm grateful for that conversation that they had as much as I screamed at him on the way home for calling my mom to tell her, and how dare you disrupt her life and bring her into this chaos and blah, blah, blah. It was my chaos, and I've been creating it for so long, and nobody wanted to deal with Beth anymore. They were just tired of dealing with Beth because Beth is not changing. So I go to this meeting in Neptune. Everybody's dressed nice. All the men are in button-up shirts and ties. And I just walked out of a hospital. And I walk in and I go, "Oh my, I don't belong here." I'm busy again, separating myself from everybody around me. But the one thing I did have was that gift of desperation that I didn't know what else to do. And based on that guy 12-stepping me, I knew something was wrong with me. I just didn't know what was wrong with me. I knew because I tried therapy for years to solve my problem, that I had a therapist telling me, "You need to go to AA," that I was lying to him, telling him I'm going to AA. Even he knew I wasn't going to AA. But he had told me, "You need to go there and you need to get a sponsor." And that night I raised my hand and I said, "Day one, and I need help." And a bunch of women approached me, and they said, "You never have to feel this way again." And a woman pulled me aside and said, I know someone, and is it okay if I give her your phone number?" And that woman called me the next day. And I'm so grateful for that because she became my sponsor. And so when I meet women today in Alcoholics Anonymous that come in here, because that woman called me, I'm not going to give you my phone number. I want your number because I'm going to call you. Because that's what saved me, because I don't think I would have ever called anybody. I was broken, but I was still blocked by a lot of pride and ego. So she said to me a couple things over the phone. "Are you willing to go to any lengths? Are you willing to take direction without debate?" At this point, I'm going to say yes to anything, but I don't know what I signed up for. She said, "I have a bunch of non-negotiables for you. I want you to call me every day." I can call her. "I want you to send me 3 things you're grateful for every day in a text message." I can do that. "I want you to get on your knees and pray." I don't know about that one. She said, "I don't care if you don't believe anything or what you believe in. These are non-negotiables. I want you to start praying. I want you to get on your knees every morning." And I said, "Okay." I didn't get honest with her for a few days. I continued to drink that weekend and lied about it. And I actually continued to lie about it for a year because I was so full of guilt and shame, and I didn't want to disappoint her because I couldn't see that I was so blocked with fear and still delusion. So my original sobriety date was actually July 29th, and today it's August 1st. And when she called me this year on July 29th, I got honest with her. And I say that because if there's people in this room though that have never gotten honest, it didn't kill me. But it ate me alive for that year. There's freedom in honesty, right? Our first step is about honesty. So I'm grateful that woman came into my life because by the time Monday rolled around, my boss is on the phone with me saying, "We want to fire you." And I've got that newcomer craziness. Blech! I can't believe she's going to do this to me, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm on the phone blowing up the sponsor's phone. She said, "You did damage. And if it's God's will, thank God you're sober today. You have a better chance of getting a job if you stay sober, if you lose this job, than if you continue to go back out. So you may be thinking about it, but it doesn't matter what you think about. It's what action are you going to take? What meeting are you going to today, Beth? Stand at the door and greet some people, Beth." And I did it, even though I rolled my eyes at her. At 30 days of sobriety, this sewer problem that I've been having in my house for, I don't know, 2 years because the tree grew into the roots or the sewer system that I'd never taken care of because I was spending all my money on alcohol, had its end with me, and the basement just blew up. And I just went, this can't be happening to me. There is no God. I don't even have a God at this point, but there is no God. And in my mind, I was going to drink and I was not going to call that sponsor. And I ended up making a phone call to the plumber that had been to my house a few months ago, because I'd had a fiance, by the way, that moved out. He was just like me, but I can't classify him. He moved out and his friend had come over and done the job for dirt cheap. And I didn't want to call him because he knew the ex. And what if he comes over and knows the ex and asks me about him and all that crazy stuff in my head instead of just calling the guy, real simple. But I overcomplicate opening a brown paper bag. So I call this gentleman and he comes right over to my house. As simple as that. And as he's walking through my house to get to my basement, he sees a big book on my table. And he says to me, how much time do you have? I said, I have 30 days. He says, I have 2 years. That guy stayed with me for 3 hours and not only fellowshipped with me, but helped me clean up that mess. And I think that was the first time that I felt genuine love in AA, because I'd been so blocked to receiving it. I was too busy comparing myself to everybody. I didn't have an open mind. I basically was in here to get my parents off my back. I knew I had a problem, but I was still in myself, well, I'm going to figure it out. Because I hadn't done any work yet to see how delusional I am. So that guy shows me love, and now the court case has come to fruition, and I'm now in a court-ordered IOP, and I'm showing up to IOP, and I'm sitting here saying, oh my God, all these people are still using. I've got 31 days. Who am I? And I'm saying none of them want to get better. But I don't know that. I didn't want to get better for a really long time. I am so different in my life today. It took me a while to get the message, but I had to see the message in somebody else. I had to keep coming to meetings to see other people carry the message, to see other people the way they were living their lives, to know that you guys had something that I wanted, even though I didn't know what that was. I just knew at that time I didn't want to drink. I knew that I was blowing up my life. That boss gave me that second chance. And at that IOP, my sponsor said to me, your job is to show up with a smile and show them what sobriety and AA looks like. And I said, you're right. She said, your primary purpose is to carry this message and stay sober. I kept going to that IOP and they were urine screening me. 3 times they came back to me and they told me, something's in your urine. And each time it was something different. And it was such minuscule amounts. And I said, what are these things? And I'm so upset and I'm calling my sponsor. And my sponsor is saying to me, you need to get honest. You need to pray to God. And I'm so frustrated because don't you know I have 35 days? You know, it was me wanting validation. I don't know whatever happened with those cups. I surmise that they were putting the lids down is what I saw on the back of the toilet. But what I do is I gotta be right. And I tell my sponsor, I'm going to get a hair test. And she freaks out, right? Because I gotta be right. And we all know what that means in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I gotta be right. Would I rather be happy or would I rather be right? And I had to be right. Because I didn't have any solution yet. So not only do I have to be right and I go get this hair test, but I escalate the situation even more. I'm supposed to meet that newcomer at a meeting. And I call somebody in the program and I say, can I make her your problem tonight? Oh, my sponsor did not like hearing that one. And I don't blame her today. Because my job is to carry the message. And I didn't want to do it because I had other plans for myself. Because I didn't have a God in my understanding. Because I had no faith. Because I was still busy playing God. And I thought, well, I'm not at the IOP flipping tables. I will rationalize and justify my behavior any way that I can. I get that hair test back, and it goes back 90 days. I'm validated. And she says to me, don't show them it. What do you mean, don't show them it? This shows that I'm right. You don't have to be right. God is going to take care of you. They extended my IOP stay for another 6 months. And during that time, every day I showed up that I had to show up, and I was a blessing there. And I got off probation, and my entire record was erased. I didn't need that hair test. But in that moment, I couldn't see that because I didn't yet have a God of my understanding. Because I still had to play God. Because I was still on self-will. Because there was no faith that no matter what, something was going to take care of me. So at 90 days, I start going through this work. And I've been hearing a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, well, you're here, so you have step one. That I did not. And as I start going through this work, I start seeing that a desire to stop drinking earns me a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is not enough to keep me sober. I start learning from reading Bill's story and going through There Is a Solution and more about alcoholism that self-knowledge avails me nothing. And all this knowledge that I had, because I lost an uncle to this disease, he died in a drunk driving accident, and I would later lose my cousin, his son, 3 years before I came to sobriety. So I knew what alcoholism looked like in my family. I knew when my father said to me at 16, we shouldn't drink. I knew a lot about alcoholism, and it wasn't enough. Fear was not enough to keep me sober. All those consequences I had, those arrests that I had, the divorce that I had, it's not enough. I needed to go through the work and have a step one experience because my mind was so delusional, I will eventually talk my way out of it. And I needed to know that I'm doomed. You know, in Bill's story, he's standing in the Mayflower Hotel, and he's gone through this work. And I look at Dr. Bob's story, and he's in the Oxford group, and he's having Bible studies at his house. It's not just having a God of your understanding. It's working with another alcoholic. And I can look back today, and I can see all these little things that my sponsor was implanting in me, was to get me to work with another alcoholic right away. I get to this step two with her, and she tells me it's just a willingness to believe. And I didn't want to believe in anything because I had been raised in a Christian home, and I thought, look what they did to me. The minister slept with the pianist. The Christian school that I went to, one day they pulled me up in front of 600 children and told me I was a sinner and had them all pray for me. And she told me, just be willing. Do you believe that I have something working in my life? And I said, I do. Do you believe that other people in this room have something working in their life? I said, I do. That's all you got to believe for right now. We'll continue to do the rest of this work. She had me read Came to Believe, AA conference approved material. And as I began to read that book, I began to see all those things that I just told you about. It wasn't God that wronged me. It was man that wronged me. It was humanness that wronged me. And I get to step three, where it talks about being convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I begin to hear that selfish self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. And I think, nah, still show up and do things for my mom, still a good friend. That's not what it's about. When things aren't going my way, or put it this way, when things are going my way, my sobriety looks real easy. When things aren't going my way, my alcoholism is really alive. I begin to play God. I begin to want to figure things out. I begin to want to insert my opinions into your life. And I got a lot of those. And I can't see that when my boss doesn't call me back for a month, that I start taking her inventory and I start to get more gracious. Maybe if I send her an email, you haven't called me back, to let her know how wrong she is for not doing that. But that's really the selfish self-centeredness. I'm so full of self that for me, that conscious separation that I talked about before, a lot of that is my ego. And Bill says in here that it's egocentric, right? He talks about businessman lolling in the Florida sun, a minister complaining about the world. That's because I'm so concerned about what you're doing to me, not doing for me, not saying to me, not loving me enough. Not calling me back for a month. I can never see the flip side of the coin, that maybe my boss is just not a good communicator. Maybe I didn't communicate right and tell her how important it was. I'm always pointing the finger, and when I don't get what Beth wants, I either take it personally, I spin stories in my head, and with 10% of the facts, I will make up 90% of the story that I don't even know. And then all of a sudden, I'm the producer of confusion rather than harmony. I go through this fear inventory, and this resentment inventory, and this sex conduct with the sponsor, and I begin to look that the world is always wronging me. Why is that? Because I'm the problem. Because self is my problem. Because a disconnect from a higher power is my problem. Because when my mom at 14 is asking me not to reach in the middle of a loaf of that bread to get the softest slices, I just simply can't do it because I want what I want. I want the softest slices. That when I look at my inventory and I see how pride, self-esteem, ambition, sex relations, right? And I mean sex relation in the meaning of what a mom should be. My mom should be loving and happy and a mom to me. My belief and my idea that my mom didn't show up the way I expected her and wanted to her and believed she should be. And when you hurt me and I have an open wound and you throw water on it, it stings. And that's what that four step showed me, is I had these things, these old ideas and these beliefs. What a boss should be. A boss should be a communicator. So when she doesn't communicate with me, I'm off to the races in my head, creating stories that aren't there. My mom, maybe she was mentally challenged in her own ways. My mom still loved me, but my mom couldn't show up the way I wanted her to. My mom will actually never show up the way I wanted her to. But I get down to the cause and conditions and these underlying fears and beliefs. Because the fear behind that pride and that mom should be a certain way is what drives me to react to a mother that I can't be the daughter that God intended me to be. You know, I learned in the fourth step with this fear inventory, I've been assigned the role of a daughter. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us, and humbly rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? This mom that I have when I get into AA, I think, I'll start calling my mom once a week. I'm a good AA-er. I'm calling my mom once a week. She's getting more from me than I've ever given her. I'm a good daughter. I'm calling my mom once a week. And I get a new sponsor and says, you know, some people actually call their moms every day, Beth. And I said, not me, not my mom. My mom's toxic. She's mean. She's hurtful. And she points out, I've been assigned a role. My mom deserves a daughter. My mom lives in a dark cave. And it's a really scary place. And I used to live in a dark cave when I was active. My mom wants to pull me in that dark cave with her. I used to go in that dark cave with her to fix, manage, and control things. And it didn't work. Today, I stand outside that dark cave, and I am the light. And I don't go in that dark cave with her. And I don't feed in any of that stuff. But I can love my mom the way she deserves to be loved, no matter how she shows up. Because today, I have a God of my understanding that gives me strength to do that. So when my mom says mean things to me that I'd rather be dead, and you don't pay enough attention to me, and all that stuff, today I'm right with God. Because today, I show up for my mom. My mom gets called Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 12 o'clock, and I don't miss a phone call. I see my mom every weekend now, and it doesn't matter how my mom shows up. My mom says some mean, hurtful things to me sometimes, but I understand that that's my mom's level of consciousness. My mom's unconscious. I was unconscious. I get a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and I have periods of today where I'm conscious. That God lives inside me. Whatever that looks like for you, I don't know. And it doesn't matter what it looks like for me, you just need to know that I have one. But I hear a different voice now. And when I run over and react to her and say, you don't need to say those things, and blah, 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 I get to hear that other voice that goes, you don't need to rationalize or justify or be right or be mean or share your opinion or try to fix her. You just need to love her. Love and tolerance is our code. God gives me the strength to show up and zip it today. My relationship with my mom looks a lot different. You know, she's a lonely woman, and I feel for her today because I have compassion for me from doing this work. When I have compassion for me, I can have compassion for others. And it's given me compassion for her. She's never going to show up the way I want her to show up. But when I let go of those old ideas and beliefs, I can show up and be the daughter that God intended me to be. So I go through this fifth step, and I see that a lot of these things that are driving me are based on fear. You know, I talked before about I'm either above you or I'm below you. But a lot of the things that I didn't see, because I couldn't see, because I didn't do the work yet, that a lot of these resentments that I had were driven by fear. What it boils down to is like five things every time I've done the work. I'm not good enough. You know, I get upset when people like my boss, you're not respecting me enough, you're not communicating with me enough. It really has nothing to do with what you're not doing and what you're not giving to me. Doing the work makes me okay with me. It shows me how I show up in life. It shows me that these underlying fears of needing to be validated and respected and whatever else that it is that I put on that fourth step has really nothing to do with what I want and what I need. It's this fear. Fear that I'm not good enough, or I'm different, or I'm not loved, or I'm not valued. And when this God of my understanding fills that hole today and gives me all of those things, and I'm not looking for it from my mother, I'm not looking for it in outside things like men. You know, I do 6 and 7, and my sponsor helps me, you know, see some of the defects of character that I have, and a lot of it is I'm busy taking things so personally all the time. And I don't have to take things personally. When I understand your level of consciousness may not be my level of consciousness, maybe I don't get hurt so much. Because you, just like me, operate in 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And when I see that I have behaved in those ways, then when people start to react to me and I start feeling that inner hurt, I can go, maybe they're reacting from that place that I've always reacted from. That realization that I have behaved like them too. And that's what a lot of this work does for me. I can't see it until I actually do it. And I believe in writing it out because God works through my hands. I get to this 9th step amends, and obviously the biggest one is probably my mother. And my mom let me have it. And she is probably the hardest one, and you know what? I deserved everything that she said. And there's humility behind hearing everything she had to say to me, because I was not showing up the way I needed to be. I have a living amends to that woman, which is part of those phone calls. But I thought, things still aren't just right. I have a relationship with my mom. I'm trying to call her every day. And it comes down to writing out that 10th step, and it's over a little resentment that I caught against my mom. And my sponsor says to me, you didn't make that financial amends, did you? I said, I don't even know what the number is. So I spend some time, and I go through the work, and I start looking for this number, and I come up with $21,000. And I go back to my mom, and I don't do that official amends again, but I say, you know what? You deserve to be paid back. You deserve a daughter that gives you everything that she took from you. Let me do this. My mom says it's $40,000. But I'm okay with that. I did damage. You know, I still have a little bit of fear every now and then over the fear of financial insecurity. I'm never going to be, like, completely secure. I may lose my job tomorrow. But what I've had experience in the last 2 years is digging myself out of another $30,000 worth of debt with credit card companies. And I've managed to do it. Not on my will, but because I had a God of my understanding. Last December, I ended up falling and I tore my ACL and my MCL. And the first thought I had was fear. This is going to cost me thousands of dollars. How am I going to do this? I have all this credit card debt. I managed to do it. I just had to trust God. So I build all these sober references. And by talking to other women in this program who have been in my shoes. You know, I came into this program, and the other thing that I went through that I like to share at meetings because I know I'm not the only one sometimes. A lot of my self-willness, boyfriend and fiance that I'd had before I got into the program was because I wanted this white picket fence and these 2.5 kids. And when that wasn't happening for me, I drank. And I went to the doctor to try to figure out why that wasn't happening for me. And they did a lot of tests, and I went and did more tests. And in sobriety, I didn't want to go back there. I didn't want the answers. And my sponsor said, you're accountable and responsible, no matter what. You have a loving God. And you're going to go back, and you're going to get those results. And I went back, and I got those results. And I can't have children. And I wasn't devastated this time. Because today I have a loving God. I have a family in AA. If God wants to bring somebody into my life down the road that has children, I'm open to whatever plan it is, but it's not my plan anymore. I'm okay. And I'm going to be okay. God's put some wonderful women in my life. I want to thank Paula and Noelle for taking this drive with me. You know, AA fills my heart. And when my sponsor had said to me, the more AA I put in my life, the bigger my life is going to get. At first, when I had like 30 days, I balked at that. Today, it's an amazing experience. I have to take a lot of action to be here. And the times that I don't feel like being here, or I don't feel like writing a 10th step on that minor nuisance, all of a sudden, Beth starts behaving poorly like 2 days later. Beth starts taking things out on people slowly, because I think it's so minor. Or Beth gets into self-pity and doesn't feel like leaving the house, going to a meeting and showing up for women. I need to be in that 10th step for everything that creeps into my life. You know, I have a daily reprieve. And the 10th step is a daily step if it needs to be. I can't carry around that stuff anymore. The type of alcoholic I am, I don't want to go back out. I've been given an amazing life today. I don't have to fear alcohol anymore. I went to a wedding last month. My best friend's in Maryland's daughter got married, and she tells me it's going to be a 5-hour wedding. Till 11 p.m. You need to stay. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? I don't want to stay there for that long, especially when they're drunk. You know what? I don't have to stay there for that long. I don't have to please everyone. I don't have to get your validation. I just had to show up at that wedding to be a blessing. And when I wasn't no longer being a blessing, and that atmosphere changed, and that gut said to me, it's time to go, I got to leave that wedding without any guilt over her, you need to stay till 11. Because I showed up and I was the blessing that she needed me to be. Because today I don't own that fear, shame, and guilt. I can still go around the triangle, and when I go around fear, anger, guilt, I'll just keep going around that until I stop and write it out. And it's uncomfortable, and it's icky, and I don't like doing it. And I can mostly see when I'm doing it so that I can get it on paper and share it with somebody if it needs to be shared. You know, that 11th step talks about prayer and meditation. That sponsor had me pray every morning to that God that I didn't know that I had at the beginning. And today my relationship has grown with the God of my understanding. That phone got tucked underneath the bed every night so that in the morning it wasn't the first thing that I looked at. and I had to get on my knees to pray. That meditation that I didn't know what I was doing when I started doing it, I've now experimented with a lot of things. Started off with 5 minutes, went to 10 minutes, now my average meditation is 20 or 30, but I do not leave the house without doing those things. The moment I stop doing those things is the moment that I start taking my will back. I have a God that I bring in throughout my day. You know, the 11th step talks about thy will be done. Pause when agitated or doubtful. I couldn't do those things until I did the work. Because I needed a God of my understanding. Otherwise, those were just slogans being slung at me. I needed to see how I show up in life to be able to address a lot of those things. So the 11th step also talks about reading books that aren't just AA. So I grow in my spirituality by picking up other things. The spirituality of imperfection. Eckhart Tolle, just being in the now. Right? Because a lot of times when I'm miserable and I'm having a bad day, it's because I just can't be in the now. Make my own misery because I'm spinning. And if I could just be in the now, that's the only place that I connect to God. And when I pause and I remember to do that, I get a little bit of peace and serenity. Or when I pause and I go, you know what? Tell that egoic voice, that self-obsessed person that's talking to me all the time. Tell that voice to shut up. And listen for the voice of the Spirit who wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, I get to the 12th step. You know, practicing these principles in all my affairs, carrying this message, the message, not my message, the message. I get to show up at a hospital today for a woman that I met a couple months ago, who's puking on herself, looking as bad as she possibly can, and I get to carry this message to her. And she didn't get the message, but you know what? It ensured my sobriety for that day. Because I did God's will. Because that's what we do. I don't just come to meetings and carry the message. We go out and we look for people to carry the message to. Because there's a lot of them that don't know about AA. You know, stay close to him, perform his work well. Comes from the 3rd step. And for me, that's a lot of what the 12th step is. Stay close to him and perform his work well. And that's what I try to do every day. And I fall short often, but I have an amends process for that. I have a sponsor for that. I have some amazing women for that. I stay active. I have a coffee commitment. I have a booker's commitment in another meeting. I'm constantly with women, driving them to meetings, working with other women. That's the joy of my life, the joy of living. I have other joys in my life too. But that's really what fills that hole in my heart today. Is that I get to come out here and deliver a meeting. I get to drive home tonight and fellowship with 2 amazing women. And that's the blessing, and I'm so grateful to be here, and thank you for having me.